Hey, gang, I want to tell you about True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products. They are fantastic. I've been using them now for a couple of months. I've used their balms. I've used their oils to sleep. And today, I'll be talking about a whole new product. Now, listen, True Hemp Science promises you premium quality, pure ingredients, and true value. They source the highest grade organic hemp from around the world to handcraft the finest full spectrum CBD products. They offer a complete line of CBD products, including full spectrum CBD oils, tinctures, CBD skincare lotions, CBD sports rubs, CBD gummies, and CBD gluten-free chocolates. They number their CBD products to differentiate them by strain, by farm, and by extraction method. Now, last week I was telling you about the number 81, which is great for relaxation and sleep. But today I'm going to be talking to you about number G41. That's full spectrum CBG plus CBDA plus terpenes. Now, this has given me some focus. It has some CBD in it, but it doesn't make you sleepy or tired or foggy in any way. The CBG kind of gives you some focus and it energizes your brain while keeping you calm and cool. You know what I'm saying? People report it relaxes their brain and does not affect cognitive performance. While it is calming, it is less physically so than CBD. It's great for working. It's great for getting your work done. I'm even using it right now. So, gang, how did I get here as partnered with True Hemp Science Full Spectrum CBD products? And if you use the code HDIGH, you will get something special. Purchase $65 worth of regular price products and receive 296 milligrams of number 81 distillate. That's the one I was telling you about. That's great for rest, relaxation, and sleep. Just go to truehempscience.com/HDIGH. For how did I get here? And you can also visit them at their brick and mortar store. That's right. They have a physical location right here in Austin at 505 West Mary Street, Unit C, Austin, Texas. Don't forget, use the code HDIGH. If you're already using CBD products, switch over to this one. I promise it's going to be great. You're going to love it. All these products are great. And the CBG, CBDA is unbelievable. Like I'm telling you, I feel very clear. I feel very focused. I haven't been drinking a bunch of coffee all day, and I'm not all anxious from coffee. You know what I'm saying? TrueHempScience.com, HDIGH. You're not only getting yourself some CBD, but you're helping us out here, right? By using the code HDIGH. TrueHempScience.com. Go get your full spectrum CBD products today. Let's get down.
How did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Holly.
All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. I hope you guys all had a good weekend. I hope that you are all safe and healthy wherever it is that you are in your life right now. If you're walking the trail, or if you're out driving a car, driving to work, riding the exercise bicycle at the gym, you look at those people. They don't have anything on you. You're the number one person. I hope you're healthy. I hope you're safe. I had a good weekend. I was watching my cousin's dog last week while she went and worked on a commercial in Mexico City. And I was watching her dog until Friday when she was going to come back. And then Saturday I had a private gig in Houston, a solo one. I'll tell you about that in a second too. Anyway, so she was going to come back Friday, get her dog back. Then I was going to go to Houston, take my dog there, let him stay with my grandma, go play this gig, hang out with them, come back. Okay, so that was going to be my thing on the weekend. But my cousin texted me on Thursday morning, and she had COVID. She had tested positive for COVID in Mexico, which sounds like a nightmare situation, which kind of ended up being a nightmare situation. But she was in a nice hotel, living the dream. She hung out on Friday, and she ended up... there was like an evacuation company is what it was called. And they flew her back like on an ambulance plane or something in a stretcher, and then took her like in a stretcher, like in an ambulance back to her house and stuff. It's all kind of crazy sounding. But she made it back on Saturday by midnight. She made it back. It was like a 10 hour ordeal trying to fly back from there to here, but she made it. She's safe. I went to Houston on Friday and, to play this show. Lovely lady's birthday is Lady Jamie, and her family had me down to play her birthday at this place. I can't remember the name of it. Scholars and Scoundrels, I think is what it's called. They were really nice people there, man. They were having like their 2-year anniversary. It was really, really fun. In fact, it didn't really feel like I was playing a gig. It felt like I was just going to a party and hanging out. Everyone was really sweet. We all had a good time. I had a lot of drinks. I was glad I Ubered there and Ubered home, but I did. I had a lot of drinks. And somehow I thought that she was like, oh, and I want you to hang out and eat with us. So I thought there was like an actual like dinner portion of that. Like we were all going to go to another part of the place and sit down and have dinner. But that wasn't the case. A DJ started after I played and I ended up just not eating. So I was pretty drunk. Anyway, made it home on Sunday. Feeling good, laying around with Rosie a lot. It's raining today when I'm doing this, but I think we're going to get out and go walk around a little bit before the sun goes down. Gang, I have a great show for you today. Brad Barr from the band The Barr Brothers has just released an instrumental solo guitar album that's absolutely gorgeous, man. It just came out last Friday on Secret City Records. It's gorgeous. It's very soundtracky. It gives you feelings. It also has that discreet music vibe where it's not trying to tell you anything. It's just kind of being music for you to enjoy as you move throughout the day. I'm a big fan of that stuff. Very big fan of that sort of ambient music that doesn't grab you by the throat and make you listen to it. But this is just gorgeous, man. This record, the first time I really listened to it all the way through, I was walking around the lake with Rosie, my dog, and it was just so, it matched what I was seeing. It felt like what I was doing when I was walking. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous record. Get out there and check it out. The Winter Mission by Brad Barr. We have a great conversation about what the Barr brothers are up to. You know, man, you know, they're brothers, right? But they tour, they do the whole band thing. And one guy lives upstairs from the other guy. He tells me that at the end of the thing. And they have their own kids and their own wives and stuff. But they live in a duplex, I guess, upstairs and downstairs thing. So close family, very close family. We also talk about his attachment to the number 216 for over 20 years. It's been a factor in his life, and he sees it and he knows it. But it's a thing with him and his friends from when he was a kid. Great. Great, great conversation. He is such a cool guy. We talk about guitar stuff. We talk about life stuff. He didn't know me. So, we go back and forth a little bit on stuff like, hey, how about you? It was really, really wonderful talking to him. And I hope that you enjoy my conversation with this amazingly talented dude, Brad Barr. Check out his album, The Winter Mission, out now on Secret City Records. Great, great, great conversation. Please enjoy it. This is me and Brad Barr chatting it up. Let's get down. What I was saying is that this says you did it as a solo thing, and I know that you were kind of improvising on some stuff as well. But like I was pointing out on a song like 216, it sounds like there's some different stuff going on. How did you do that?
There were two songs on the record where I used a loop of some kind. So on 216, it's a piece of thread that I tie onto the guitar string. Could probably show you. Is this a video podcast?
No.
It's just audio, right? Yeah. Okay, so it's a trick I learned from a Romanian violinist, where he tied a horsehair from his bow onto his violin string and then pulled on the horsehair and got a vibration going between his fingers. So on that track, I used a looping pedal to loop the vibration produced by pulling a piece of sewing thread tied to a guitar string. The other track that has a sort of drone going on is a song called Baseball, where I used a Strucci box.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually an electric tambura. So they sell them at the Ali Akbar Khan School of Music. It's like a little box that emulates the sound of a tambura, which is a sort of drone, an Indian instrument that creates a drone. So, and that one I just put next to me in the room while I recorded.
That's awesome.
The guitar. But, the idea with that record actually was to make every song is just a single performance. There's no overdubs. So every track can be done. Every track is done by just one person, that person being me.
Yeah.
It was sort of the challenge I gave myself. So any other sounds you hear were not like studio overdubs. They were all things that could be done live.
Yeah. Well, it's amazing and it's beautiful. And it's really, do you ever listen to like Brian Eno's ambient records and stuff like that?
Oh yeah. A lot lately, actually. He's been a go-to.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like it for me too, during the pandemic. There was also like this 3-hour documentary about him, like his work just in the 70s that was on Amazon Prime.
Really?
Yeah, that was like mind-blowing. But this record feels like it's from that same family tree, like the acoustic guitar response to his synthesizer and piano stuff.
Yeah, it's meditative, I guess, and it Very. Would be one word I would use to describe it. It's hypnotic, maybe more hypnotic than most of the music I've created in the past.
Right.
And I guess that, is cool. The guys, you know, the whole project started when some guys from a theater company in New York contacted me to, they wanted to commission some music for their theater to use in various shows or online. And, the whole thing was just like what the first few tracks I made, I was like, is this what you're thinking? Is this kind of along the lines? And he was like, you know, Brad, this is for you to explore whatever you want to do. So it was really a liberating thing. I had to kind of ask myself what kind of music I wanted to make or what kind of music I was compelled to make. And it came out much, much more, kind of hypnotic and trancy than anything I've done in the past.
Yeah, because
so maybe that was
your work with the Barr Brothers, at least even the earlier stuff, because I was going to say the last singles that you guys put out in 2016, the instrumental one definitely has like almost like a Pink Floyd feeling song. And then the one
you heard that
thing
I think called Red Moth Solar Companion, which is instrumental.
That's right.
It's like 2000, I think we put that out at the beginning of the pandemic. But it recorded in 2016. But
The next song, like the drums have this real like Jesus and Mary chain kind of like dreamy, like, you know what I'm talking about?
Saint Cecilia.
It sounds like, Saint Cecilia. It sounds like you've sort of started taking those sort of like dreamier turns. Not that rest of your records weren't, there's just more straight ahead kind of like songwriting.
Yeah, I think we have, Andrew and I, the hardest thing is to sort of pick a direction to go in and to really make something that's going to translate well. I think we just sort of, I don't know. Cause there was never a conscious decision to make, you know, dreamier, more kind of hypnotic music. But I think putting a record together sometimes doesn't leave a lot of room for that because you've got these individual songs that, you know, kind of want to get in and get out, you know, when there's whatever 10 songs together. So I know with those two tracks, when we released them, it was like, they finally have they can exist just on their own. Cause they are very kind of long or they have that hypnotic quality. You can sit with it for 6-7 minutes. And maybe the fact that they weren't part of a whole record made it make more sense to, you know, for put them out like that.
Right. Right. Did you, like doing the Winter Mission, did you, the other songs, like there's a structure to the songs, right? And so in these, there's improvisational times. I'm sure there's stuff you probably had come up with kind of, like themes, but how liberating was it as a songwriter to sort of like shed that structure and sort of like bask in that freedom? You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, even more liberating than that was not having to write lyrics for a whole bunch of songs.
Yeah, totally.
That was extremely refreshing. I was like reminded of, I was scratching my head, like, why do I spend, I really bang my head against the wall trying to put lyrics to songs, and a lot of them disappear because I get stuck with a verse or a chorus or whatever, couldn't figure out the line, and I just abandon it. And writing these was so easy in that sense, the composition side, that it, because I am kind of a guitarist first and a singer second, and improvising on the guitar, for me, I imagine it feels the way like a real true singer who can just sort of walk into any situation and open their mouth and they trust what's going to come out. For me, it's like that with the guitar. So it was really liberating to do that. And yeah, I did sort of just intuitively write songs that I could improvise on, that I knew I could deliver a motif, a little, you know, this little story at the beginning, and then just stretch. That was what I wanted to hear myself do.
Yeah. Where are you right now?
I was just about to ask you the same question, actually.
I'm in Austin, Texas.
Oh, no shit. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
The guitar on the track Baseball, is a 19 mid 30s Oahu lap slide guitar that I bought in Austin.
Oh, really?
Texas. In like an antique store, actually, not even a music store.
Just, oh, wow.
Yeah, up there. Oh, it's that same stretch, the great coffee shop. Congress, is that what it's called? Congress?
Yeah.
Their street. Yeah. On Congress, is it on the way out of town? I'm in Montreal.
Oh, wow.
And just to give you an idea, give you a quick idea, it looks.
Oh my goodness!
Looks like that right now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Snow's coming down hard.
I think it started snowing at like 4 a.m. and there's already almost 2 feet of snow.
Wow. So what do you do on a day like that? You just hang inside? I was laughing earlier when you were talking. You were saying something serious, and I started laughing, and I was like, I hope he doesn't take this wrong, but it sounded for a minute like you were in a telemarketing department of some place that only employs children.
Oh, you're talking about the background sounds there?
Yeah.
My wife is giving my son a haircut right now.
That's nice.
Yeah.
How old is he?
But he's 7.
Okay.
He's 7 years old. What do you do? We're now at the point, just pulling stuff out of our ass. I think, I'm going to make a track with him in a little bit. I like loading up GarageBand, and we just mess around on the keyboard, maybe make an igloo, play some Uno.
Maybe make an igloo and play some Uno. That sounds good. Have you been able to get out and play?
We did a 10-day tour with my old band before the Barr Brothers. It's called The Slip.
Uh-huh.
A three-piece kind of improv band. And we did 10 days down the East Coast in mid-November. That felt really normal. Felt really good. good turnouts. Felt like the way it is supposed to feel. And that was it. I did one show for this record, just like 25 people in a small space here in Montreal. Just kind of called some people up and said, I'm doing it just to kind of break the ice on this music, because I haven't done any strictly instrumental performances. I haven't tried any of this music live from the Winter Commission. So
right.
I wanted to try that out in a small group. And it was really cool.
Did you have to go back and like learn it? Since you improvised like a lot of it, you had to go back and like kind of figure out what you did?
Exactly. I had to do just that. Yeah. Because some of the pieces, like the one I released, The Ancient Calendars, it's an improv, but it's also like, I don't know, there's tunings and capos and hand positions, things I got to kind of recall that. And once they come back, it's really, can just kind of run with it. But yeah, I had to relearn my own tunes. Yeah.
Are you planning to, are you going to be able to do some other shows?
Man, I hope so.
On behalf of the album?
I hope so. I had booked one in New York, actually, on February 16th, just 216, it referenced that number.
Right, right.
And we just canceled it. The guys who booked it, it was with the theater company in New York, and they just, we just talked on Friday, and we all decided at worst it could be pretty irresponsible, and at best probably under attended.
That's a really the irresponsible thing is something that just it's starting to come up now, right? Now that I don't know about you, I'm vaccinated, I'm boosted, plus I had a breakthrough case after I got vaccinated, and so
what's a breakthrough case?
It's when you're vaccinated and you get it.
Oh, you got it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that go?
It wasn't bad. I mean, I was vaccinated. It really wasn't bad. I felt like I was on acid for a couple of days.
Yeah.
And then I was real tired for a few days, and I couldn't taste anything or smell anything.
Okay. For a few days.
For like a week and a half. Yeah.
Huh. Didn't sound too bad.
No, but
not to downplay it, but yeah.
No. And what I was going to say is I played a gig on Friday here in Austin with my band at this place, Antones, and there was a conversation within the band the week before, or not the week before, a couple of days before, that was just kind of like, are we doing the right thing? So there is that thing where like, hey, we got to make a living, but then there's also like, man, people don't know what they're doing. And if we tell them to show up at this place and they all do, it's our fault that they all get sick. In a way.
Yeah. I mean, that's it. It could be looked at, it could be perceived that way. I what I'll say about it is here in Quebec, in Canada, Montreal especially, there's not even before COVID, there's been a real like, this feeling of social responsibility, you know, what if everybody did that kind of idea,
right.
Is really prevalent here. I'm American, you know, I grew up in Rhode Island. And so, you know, I'll run red lights if there are no cars coming. I don't know, any number of things that I'm like, oh, what's the problem? If I just do this, doing this thing. But my wife gets on my case. She's like, basically, what if everybody did that? And then right. you have this free for all. So all to say, Quebecers are very considerate and concerned about that idea of social responsibility when it comes to this thing, especially.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know if it's making a difference. Like it's exploding over here. So
it's exploding everywhere right now, I think, or at least here it is.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let me ask you this. How did you end up in Quebec? Your wife?
Actually, no, my brother, moved here to be with now his wife. We'd been in Boston for about 10 years. That band I mentioned, The Slip, was touring up in Montreal. We played a gig. He met this girl. He sort of pursued her, and then in 2005 told me he was going to move here to be with her. And I think I made it about a month in Boston without him before before I packed all my stuff into my car and drove up here and had him find me a little apartment. So that was 2005. I met my wife in 2012. So I'd been here about 7 years, just sort of, I mean, I love Montreal. Have you ever been here?
I was there when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I can't remember it.
Yeah. I had been too. A lot of people, I think, were here when they were kids, and I saw the Expos play, actually. But yeah, having come up here with a band, it's just like this. I remember thinking the city just is amazing.
Yeah,
they're liberated. It's a lot of cool stuff. It's beautiful. Coffee's great. You have really like high quality of life, you know, without paying too much money.
Yeah, that's a fortunate thing. We're losing that in Austin, that's for sure.
Shit. Really, I mean, I would think you guys. Okay.
I mean,
I'll take your word for it.
It's a cool town, but like it's becoming. Like where I live in town, like right next to downtown, and it's slowly becoming unaffordable for a lot of people. You know, they got to move out to the suburbs or whatever. So, dude, so you're from Rhode Island.
Yeah.
You were born there. What did your,
yeah.
And your, how many brothers and sisters do you have?
Just one. Just my brother, Andrew. He's two years younger. Yeah.
What did your parents do like for a living?
Kids. My dad's a dentist.
Oh yeah.
Just sold his practice after 47 years of being at the same practice, not missing a single day from being sick or anything. And my mom was a culinary professional. She was actually she was Julia Child's executive chef.
What?
For about 12. Yeah, she and Julia would travel as a duo. So whenever Julia had an engagement, you know, a TV show, an interview, a spot somewhere, my mom would go with her as like her assistant, pretty much.
Did you ever meet
her?
So,
yeah, lots of times.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah. Total side story to my upbringing, but yeah, I actually ate a hot dog from a hot dog vendor in New York City on the corner with Julia Child when I was about
nine years old.
Yeah. Yeah. And you know what's funny, Julia, you know, she ate her hot dogs, not straight on. Right. But she ate it like a corn on the cob that way. Just a little fact.
That's so weird.
I may be one of the only people that know that.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you said you and your brother started playing music early?
Yeah, about eight, 9 years old.
How did you find it? Like, what made you want to play?
Probably MTV,
yeah.
I'm guessing, would be like the most honest response to that. And that we needed, I think our parents recognized that we needed some outlet, you know, or we were going to beat on each other all the time. So I think it was just showing some interest in, my dad had a guitar, but he rarely played, showing a little interest in that. I took piano lessons. I just remember one Christmas coming down and there was a drum set there. I don't think either of us had asked for a drum set, but and my brother immediately ran over to drum set and started playing it. And then they said, it's to Brad. The kids, I was like, oh, all right. I got a set of drums for Christmas and he got a guitar. And for about a year, we fumbled around, like not figuring anything out. And then we figured out, we switched.
It's like the Van Halen brothers.
Oh yeah, did they start out?
Yeah, they started out on the opposite instruments and they switched.
I never knew that. Okay, that's
yeah.
No, really? Okay.
I can't believe I'm the first guy telling you that.
Yeah, never. I mean, I don't tell that story too often, but okay. Well, maybe that's more common. I mean, yeah, and then it was just, you know, it really just took like one neighbor. It was just one neighbor, this kid who was like, you got drums and a guitar? Well, let's do something. And he was like a couple years older. He would always come over and want to make music together. And we just were like, okay, we wanted to be cool. We wanted him to be, you know, we wanted to impress him and wanted him to hang out because he was a super fun, cool guy. So we just kept going at it. And pretty soon we could play, you know, Wipeout and Summer 69 and Johnny Be Good and a couple of AC/DC tunes. And that was pretty much the beginning. You know, I think by 13 or 14, I wrote a few tunes and we recorded them. That was like the first time I went into a studio. But yeah.
Oh, you went into a studio?
When I was about 14. So my dad, being a dentist, he had a patient with a recording studio.
Right, right.
So he traded dental work for studio time for his kids.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's really awesome.
He also traded dental work for African drum lessons for my brother.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah, any chance he could get to you know, sort of encourage our career with, you know, you find one of his patients who could hook us up. He'd be like, oh, you got a studio. If we want to do work out a little deal. So he's a great dad that way.
Wow. What an awesome, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So what were those songs that you recorded? They're ones you wrote. What were they like?
They were basically AC/DC songs.
Rewritten.
With different lyrics. Yeah. It was, yeah. And a little bit of Grateful Dead in there. AC/DC and Grateful Dead were kind of,
those are polar
14
opposites when, though.
I know you think they are, but, I'm still, yeah, there's a connection in there somehow. So they both fit into my, you know, record collection at the time. So
how were you, like, what was going on like in the regular musical culture at the time that you weren't connecting with it? You were doing AC/DC and Grateful Dead stuff.
Oh, good question. Well, it's probably 89. You know, I had some awkward years there with the hair metal. I think around 11, 12, 13, it was like, you know, Guns N' Roses and
right,
Poison.
Right.
I see you got the Kiss sticker up there.
Yeah. I was a little older
than you. I was
never
a Kiss fan.
Yeah.
I was. You look good.
I was like, I'm 53. So I was like, prime age for makeup Kiss.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I could see that. Okay. You're forgiven.
Yeah. I still like their first records though. Like I really do.
I bet if things had just gone a little bit to the left or a little to the right, I could have been the Kiss fan, but
right.
It just didn't happen for me. Well, I mean, yeah, that was probably as close to, you know, Michael Jackson, when he was happening, I was pretty young, I guess. Was big, and then
wait, who was big? Sorry,
classic
you kind of froze for a second.
Guns N' Roses.
Yeah,
Guns N' Roses might have been the last time I was like really into a band that was current and popular. And,
okay,
and then after that, it kind of went. I just kept looking back. I think Zeppelin IV was one of the first really, you know, transformative records for me. I mean, Angus Young was just, for a young guitar player, is just, and even for an old guitar player, he's still, you know, I mean, he repeated himself, but those first few records were so full of heart and and tone.
It's funny because they have the most interesting sort of career like that. Like no one really gives them any shit for not changing anything. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
No one's ever been like, Jesus, seriously? Again, you can do a record that sounds just like this? And people are like, fuck yeah, dude. So they've had it. They've had the luxury.
Yeah,
of that
I can't
stuff.
Really think of. I mean, they're like jazz musicians that way. No one quite. There's just he does his thing, and
it's true. Or like Chuck Berry or something.
Well, yeah. You ever seen Chuck Berry play?
Never saw him live.
I saw him live once, and it was surreal. Like he had two humongous amps on stage. Like each one was the size of like a dresser, a bureau, and he was playing all the classic Chuck Berry riffs.
Right.
But he did not give a shit where on the fretboard he was playing them.
That's
they
it.
Had no regard for the whatever key the song was in. It was just all Chuck Berry riffs all over the neck, like really out, really abstract.
Yeah. You're saying that in a kind way, the way that you're saying it was abstract. But I heard it from a dude that played with him like in a pickup band in Houston. And he said that after his night of playing with Chuck Berry, it made him want to quit music. He was like, if that's all Chuck Berry can give, like he was just like, he's like, he said the same thing. He's just like, he didn't give a shit if it was in tune or anything.
Yeah, I was saying it kindly. I mean, really, we were standing at the back of the bar, like, what the fuck is going on? We were like, this, is he okay? We're like, is he all right? He doesn't.
Well,
and that it was so much louder than everything else on stage, and it's like a half step up.
Yeah.
I was trying to take it in. I was like, okay, I just gotta. Yeah, I mean, it kind of was, but I remember at the time I was like, well, it's Chuck Berry. I can't say anything bad about Chuck Berry. So how can I skew this?
Well,
he's moved into abstract art.
Right. My friend said that he was doing the same thing, but yelling at the band the whole time in like a really just almost inappropriate Ouch. Level. Well, I did.
Oh, that's inappropriate. That's level. So. Yeah. That's hard to see.
So when did you get out and start playing like places?
High school.
Yeah.
Actually high school. Yeah. We were kind of we were a high school cover band by 92. We were actually like sending our records to other high schools, sending our demo tape to other high schools with like a, you know, back then it was like a 8x10 glossy photo, a little write up, and we'd put our little press kit together with the cassette, the photo and the write up little thing we wrote about ourselves, I guess. And we'd mail it to other high schools. Like, you know, we're available to play your
function,
you know, your prom or your function, whatever your function is, we'll make it. We bought a PA like in high school and we'd have someone, our parents, like my brother was only 14 or 15 and we just go around. I think at one point we had many weekends booked up and we would, that was with the band, The Slip, which actually had a different lineup back then, but those were our first gigs playing other high schools in the area. Yeah. How about you? What were your first gigs?
Well, my mom was friends with these people that owned this bar outside of Houston, this town called Spring. And so my first gig was like going on stage with one of their friends and playing one of their songs. But then my first band gig was same people, but in their living room for one of their daughter's birthdays when I was in junior high.
Oh, nice.
In fact, hold on.
Nice. You got the picture.
I got the picture. It hangs on my wall so I can remember why I do this.
Oh, that's awesome. Holy pony.
It's like 1983.
Whoa.
Playing the PVM.
Nice one.
Fender Bullet.
That's great that you still have that picture.
Yeah. It's a great memory. It's like, to me, it's like that I just remember, like, it was so, you know, it was terrible. But it was like the most liberating experience. It was like whatever feeling you have, like, you know, like when you're skiing, or like riding a motorcycle, or if you could fly, that's what it was for me. It was like the end all be all.
Yeah.
And I've never tried heroin.
And then they clap for you too. Like, yeah, I just had this like exhilarating feeling. And then people are like,
yeah.
You want another one? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's pretty addictive.
pretty amazing, right?
Yeah, same for me. Yeah, I mean, even when you're not that good, people acknowledge you for getting up there and doing something.
Yeah.
You know, extroverted and inspired.
Is there a place called the Met in Providence?
Yeah, the Met Cafe.
I played there.
Yeah.
A couple of times.
With a
band.
What were the bands called?
Gowdy was the name of my band.
Okay.
And we were like on a subsidiary of Elektra that was owned by Lars Ulrich. He had a label for a couple of years and signed bands.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. But
was it metal?
No, not at all. It was rock and roll.
The Met's really nice, by the way. They just moved. They were in the same location for years. Then Lupo's closed. It's now a vintage clothing store, and the Met moved to Pawtucket. Not that I expect you to know where Pawtucket is, but
I don't.
It's still a venue. They just probably not in the same place when you played it.
Was it radio station WBRU was there too? Is that right?
Yeah, that's okay. Brown University. Yeah.
That was a good station. They seem like a good station.
Providence is a cool town.
Yeah.
Providence has like a lot of, I think it's one of the things that made me so comfortable here in Montreal is just a similar kind of DIY thing. Like a lot of artists trying to find the, you know, cheap industrial space, you know, with where there's, you know, the opposite of a condo, whatever, just a big open space where they can throw a bed in and live cheaply and do art and throw parties and play shows. It's like people kind of, and a healthy, like irreverence for the way things are, you know, quote, should be done, or the way like Boston's very kind of, there's the institution of this and the institution of that. And Providence really just throws it all to the wind.
Yeah. You know what I thought about Boston? Like the fourth time I was there playing, I ended up hanging out with some people afterwards and going to this bar. And I was like, man, that's like as racist as like Mississippi. Like Boston is intense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like there is very little tolerance in some little pockets that you get in.
Yeah. I know what you mean. I lived there for 10 years. And never really felt like I fit in there, although we did have some really good years there. But yeah, there's a really old school. I mean, the Irish Italian.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna. I am both Irish and Italian, so I think I can say that. But just an old school way of doing things. And yeah, and maybe that's kind of what I was like. There are ways in Boston really sticks to the sort of the way things are done, the way things have been done, the way things are supposed to be done. You know, and that can breed a lot of actually some really cool stuff, like the whole academic side of that. You know, I went to Berklee School of Music in Boston.
Did?
I did, yeah, for a year and a half. But just that sort of like learning the rules of a thing so that you know how to break them. You know, so you know that you know that what you're doing, that you're not repeating history. You're not, you know, yeah. So that basically shake shit up from the inside, kind of.
Did you want to go to school there? Were your parents like, "Hey, man, come on, you got to go to school," or? Oh, you froze again. You froze.
Yeah, they didn't ask me to push me towards that at all. Oh yeah, unstable. No, that was totally our call. I went there with my brother and our friend bass player, and that was the band The Slip. Sort of started there. No, we knew we wanted to go there. We knew we wanted to be around all that music.
And obviously, you left after a year and a half. But what was your overall experience there?
Well, I left Berklee after a year and a half, but I stayed in Boston for another 8 years. So
right, but Berklee
Berklee itself, It was, you know, it was all right. It was all right because I made the decision to, number one, not bitch about it. I was there by my own choice, so I wasn't going to start dissing the world of academia, you know. And I also decided that if my sort of creative inspiration can't handle a little bit of concrete sort of structure and can't handle some input from
right
the academic world, then it must not be that, you know, if it's that volatile, it's not that strong anyway. But so I decided to find a way through it and enjoy it.
That's good. So how did you guys end up forming the Barr Brothers? How did that whole thing end up going on?
That was within a couple years of arriving in Montreal. I started recording music. We found a little studio space. We still use that space. I started recording songs, more songs. When I moved to Montreal, I decided I was going to focus on songwriting because I'd always written songs, but they weren't that good. I couldn't stand behind them at the end of, by 2005, after performing for 10 years with The Slip, I didn't really have any songs that I felt like I could stand behind, that I could play in any situation, that I trusted and was confident in. So I really sat down to writing songs and that I was proud of. And, you know, I got a batch of tunes together, and then my neighbor turned out to be a harp player. I used to hear her playing harp through my bedroom wall. I could tell she was like practicing for something. I said, you know, she was practicing her harp, classical music. And one day I finally met her and we started playing. She was very open-minded. Her name is Sarah Page, and she was really cool. Wanted to, whatever I was up to, she was happy to jump on, happy to figure out a way to play music together. And so I was like, so you don't mind if we stick a pickup on your harp and run it through a fuzz pedal? And she's like, no, let's do that. I was like, all right, we can. We bought her an SVT and put a fuzz pedal on the thing. Yeah. Yeah. It was, we were like, well, what can't you do on a harp? Let's see what the limits are there. Paper through the strings so that they weren't just always ringing. She could get a real like percussive.
Right.
It almost sounded like a kalimba or something, like one of those distorted African kalimbas. Yeah, yeah. And it could also be very graceful and angelic. So
can you imagine though? Like what
and there's
the
an
odds?
Upright bass player. Yeah.
What do you think the odds are of moving in next door to a harp player? I mean,
yeah,
that's very slim odds.
And I'll tell you the truth. The harp is not an instrument I ever had any interest in. Like I never would have set out to form a band with a harp player.
Yeah.
It's just wasn't on my radar and it's an enormous instrument. It's not a convenient instrument to be in a band with. You gotta wheel it around if it's snowing in Montreal. You know, I could just remember wheeling that thing through the freaking snow, like over curbs. You know, like it takes like three people standing around making sure it doesn't topple over.
Yeah.
But we really committed. We really committed to it. We're like, well, let's. You know, we made our promise. We're like, look, if you join this band, we'll make sure. We'll always carry your harp. We'll make sure your harp gets there safe. We'll take care of it. We'll do everything we can to like make it easy. And she was super game for it. And she was for about, for about 10 or 11 years, Sarah was the harpist. And,
wow.
And then right around the tour of the last record, so around 2018, she decided she had come to the end of her road with the Barr Brothers. I'm surprised that it took that long.
Were you guys?
I thought she would have jumped ship before.
Sorry, for those years, were you touring a lot for the 2010s?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that band toured a lot. We went to Europe like maybe 3 or 4 times a year. Several tours of the States. We made it to Austin. I don't know. Not enough.
Yeah. You played with Shaky.
At least 4 or 5 times. Yeah.
Did some touring with him.
It was Shaky there.
Oh, yeah. Here?
We did some touring with My Morning Jacket. The War on Drugs. But yeah, we didn't play the South as much as I would have liked to. I always felt like we could have. I feel like the South was going to get our music more than a lot of other places.
Really?
Because it draws from so much of that.
Yeah. But Europe, they were way more receptive than the States.
Yeah, Europe also kind of had its own pockets of reception. Like Germany, we did really well in Germany. I wouldn't have figured that before. France, not so much. England, really good.
Yeah.
Didn't get to Spain much, or you know, Italy maybe a couple of times. But I loved that.
Where is all of it now with the Barr Brothers? Like what?
Got all the demos. We just keep throwing stuff at our demos, trying to figure out the next batch of tunes. Because the next batch of tunes, the next record we make, we want to be able to walk into a studio, spend no more than a week, and leaving with a record. The last 3 Barb records, the only 3 Barb Brothers records, were these enormous sprawling things that like started one place, moved to another place, took the bed tracks down to our spot, played with them like for a year, you know, chopping things. They're just these enormous affairs, these mountains of you know, creative, obsessively, you know, tweaking things.
Right.
And we don't want to do that this time. That can just be maddening. And it actually costs my brother and I like some just sort of peace of mind together. Like it inevitably, things get stressful towards the end. We start fighting. So the idea now is to like, yeah, make sure the songs are intact. A lot of the reason for that is because going into studio without necessarily knowing the song that well. So you end up having to make up for it in post-production.
Yeah. Yeah.
This time we wanted to make sure the songs were ready to go before we go into a studio. So that's what's next. It's imminent.
Yeah. So you and your brother are close. How is that? Like, it's obviously not a Gallagher Brothers situation.
Getting there. he actually lives. I live on we bought a house together. So me and my family live upstairs. My family and I live upstairs. Andrew lives downstairs with his family. We share the studio space. Yeah. We're very, very close. So much so that when we're in our house, we rarely see each other. Actually, we have to like kind of draw some boundaries. You know, when we leave the studio together, we each come to the same house, but we really don't see each other until we go back to the studio. But yeah, we have a way of working. There's like there's no grudges. There's no, I don't know what to say, like deep. Yeah, we get things out. If something needs to be said, we speak it, get out of the air, air it out,
yeah.
Move on. Excuse me. But yeah, he's a decent enough guy. He tolerates me.
That's good. That's good. Tell me about the number 216. Like, it's been coming up in your life for the last 20 years in ways.
Yeah, it's a really peculiar and sometimes kind of, sometimes it feels like it has a lot of gravity. Sometimes it's just kind of this, a little coincidental thing. When I was about 15, me and a bunch of friends are taking acid at my friend's house. And that night, that number just sort of appeared to us. It was actually the song titled "Your Dad's Awake" from the Winter Mission. Was that moment, at 2:16, my friend's dad woke up and we all had to stop, you know,
tripping,
doing whatever weird, yeah, stuff, you know, stop looking at a piece of fruit like it was a globe, you know. We had to act sort of normal because his dad came down, and for some reason we're like 2:16. That happened at 2:16. Let's remember 2:16. I don't know. We were tripping, but then now that number just kept reappearing, and now I see it all the time. I discovered it sort of became this part of our mythology as our group of friends was that number, but it also revealed itself to have these sort of, you know, numerological, cultural, mystic references, like, you know, the and just basic numeric, like mathematically, it has all these strange properties that you know, only that exist very rarely in sort of number sequences. Like, for example, prayer beads, Hindu prayer beads, there's 108 on a traditionally there's 108 of them, and they count right. them forwards and backwards. So when you see the guys counting prayer beads, they end up counting 216 of them. Oh, wow. But also, like, also, you know, really just strange things happen with it, where I pull up to a light and the car in front of me has 216 on the license plate, and right there one of these old friends from this old gang of friends will call me, like, at that moment. And that's happened several times, just strange things like that. Wow. So the number, yeah,
not superstitious or anything like that.
Not superstitious. Not like I don't put all my faith in some kind of, you know, some kind of power entity or universal mysticism, but that number keeps me kind of engaged in the mystery of the natural world, and reminds me that there's a whole lot that I don't understand, more than I don't understand than I do understand.
Right. That's the way it sort of seems like what's going on, isn't it? Like, with life as you get older.
Yeah. Thank God. I mean,
do you ever see
God? Thank God there's still stuff.
Sorry, dude. I hate Zoom is so like that weird
the delay, right?
Fucking drives me nuts.
It's all right. We're doing pretty well.
Yeah. But plus you seem like a cool guy. I'd love to hang out with you more. You seem like I got to tell you, this record is gorgeous. And I'd never heard the Barr Brothers before until I'd gotten this record from your publicist, Eric.
Eric, got in touch with you, and you were like, okay, I'll talk to that guy.
Well, I was like, I don't know the Barr Brothers, but I went and listened to your record, and I was like, this is fucking great. Like, and I got,
oh, so cool,
I caught that. I'm a big Eno fan, and like just hearing somebody making something that's just meditative music that you don't, it's not grabbing you by the throat and making you listen to it and hear what it has to say. You can just feel how you want about it. And I'll tell you this one thing, when I was listening to it in its entirety, for the first time today, I was walking my dog. I live on the trail on the lake that goes through downtown. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I do. No,
so I was walking through this beautiful nature area, and it felt like the beginning of whatever movie I was living. You know what I mean?
Oh, I think I made my reference for those tracks, my way of like deciding if they were keepers or not would be to record at the studio and then take it out for a walk. That's kind of the way I always determine if I'm behind it, is to take the thing out and a pair of headphones and just look at people, look at things. And does it make me feel like more compassionate? Like if I listen to this song, do I feel like kind of more compassionate for the world? And I'm glad to hear that it had some effect like that.
Yeah.
Is that tape machine behind you?
No, it's an old hard disk recorder, an old Roland hard disk recorder that I like recording on. It's like, and it's got an old sampler on it. I got a bunch of old shit. I got an old Rhodes.
Got a Rhodes there, nice.
54, bunch of guitars.
What's the 54? The Rhodes or the
The Rhodes is a 54 key.
54.
As opposed to the 73 key. It's like a Wurlitzer size Rhodes, basically.
Yeah.
That's what it does. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've also got piano, keyboards, and organ,
nice.
And other guitars and bass and stuff.
What's your favorite guitar over there? What's your go-to guitar?
Well, right now, my friend built me this really cool SG.
Wow. Holy pony.
I love playing it. It's an SG Junior. It's got a Bigsby on it. It's really...
He made it in the specs of an SG?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
I also have an old Telecaster that I love. Sorry. Yeah.
That's great. I just got my first SG after, you know, I've been a fan of Angus Young since I was 13, and always had reverence for the SG, but never owned one. And I finally, 2 years ago got, or maybe 3 years ago, got my first SG at 44 years old. The guitar I've been waiting for my whole life.
Congratulations.
Yeah, great. Thanks. Congrats on yours.
Oh,
that looks like
thanks.
A fun one.
I love playing it, man. Well, dude, this record will be out. This is going to come out on Tuesday. So the record will be out by the time this is out. People should go out there and check it out. The Winter Mission. It's gorgeous. And is there anything else that I should know or people should know before we go?
We covered a lot of ground. Could, I'm sure we could cover more, but I'm happy to leave it at that.
Yeah. It's really nice meeting you, man.
You too, Johnny. Yeah. Thank you so much for, it's shining a little spotlight on me. I appreciate that and getting some word out. So Gowdy was the band that would have hit the Met Cafe.
Yeah.
If I were to check out your music, would that be a good place to start?
I mean, it's like 20 years ago that record came out, but my name's Johnny Gowdy, and I have stuff that I put out a few singles last year.
Oh.
And I've got other stuff out there.
Okay, I've been reading your name until now, so I didn't know it was pronounced Gowdy. Okay.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
I was thinking like the OU together in French, you'd be ooh. Well, pleasure talking with you, man. And I hope to meet you in person one of these days.
Yeah, man, me too. Hopefully you guys, when you come down, stay in touch and maybe we can meet up when you come down to Austin next time.
Yeah, I'd love that.
All right, man. Good meeting
you. Right on, Will. Thanks again.
Cheers.
You too. Bye.
Gang, that's Brad Barr from the Barr Brothers. His album, The Winter Mission, out now. Wherever did you stream and download your jams on Secret City Records? What a great conversation, man. I really enjoyed talking to that dude. I hope we get to sit down and do it again in person. What a fantastic, fantastic dude, man. Get out there and check out this gorgeous record, The Winter Mission, now. It's beautiful. And the Barr Brothers will be putting out some new music at some point soon. It's all happening, man. It's all happening. Are you happening? Hey, gang. Don't forget if you can subscribe to this podcast wherever it is that you find podcasts, be it Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Overcast, Spotify. New shows every Tuesday and every Friday. And also From the Vault episode. From the Vault episode, episode 10. Like we're in episode 1,130 something. And I'm going to put out re-release episode 10 From the Vault. See who that is. Big mystery. Big mystery. Hey, great conversation coming up on Friday with 8.5 Souvenirs. Yeah, Olivier Giraud. Great, great dude. All right, I want to thank Brad Barr for doing the show. It was fantastic talking to him. Check out his album, The Winter Mission, now. And don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Get into it every Tuesday, every Friday. Follow us on Facebook. You can follow me on Instagram and Twitter. I am at Johnny Gowdy. Do it. Like stuff. Share it. Let us know how you feel about the show. All right? Have a great week, whatever it is you're doing. Stay safe. Be nice to each other. Be nice and don't be weird. Let's get down.